Good evening. James McCanny here with my Science Hour, October 15, 2015. A boatload of topics to cover tonight. A few that I didn't get in last week. Last week I started with a multiplication problem, and I didn't get to finish it at the end of the show. So here we go. What if you took 2 and multiplied by 2? Gee, that would be 4. And if you multiply 4 times 2, that's 8 times 2. Is 16 times 2 is 32, etc. So if you do this 7 times, you get up to a number 128. 8 times, you get up to 256. But I'm going to stop at 128. So let's take the number 5 and multiply it by itself. We get 25, and then you multiply it by another 5, and you get 125. So you only have to multiply 5 3 times, whereas you had to multiply 7 times to get up into the 120 range. So they're almost the same. 3 or 5 cubed, or 5 times 5 times 5 equals 125. 2 to the 7th is 128. So about the same number. And so it just shows you the multiplication of numbers if you do something 5 times. So anyway, the point of this little exercise has to do with exponential growth. And so if you were a cell and you could multiply, instead of dividing into 2, if you could multiply 5 times every time, then you would grow much faster. So there's a point here. Take an oak tree. If you planted 1 acorn and it grew an oak tree, they say within 75 years unabated, that oak tree would produce enough oak seeds which would reproduce, then growing, you know, that those oak trees then would grow up and then reproduce again. In 75 years, there would be enough oak trees to cover the entire planet. And so this gives another example of multiplication of exponential growth. The whole point is that there are businesses out there, and what's the biggest drawback to operating a business? Well, capital. If you want to grow, you need capital to grow, and that's the limit to most businesses. What if you could find a business where you did not need to put in your own capital? All you had to do is work. Somebody else put their capital in. The product was already there. And all you had to do was promote it, and if it was a good product, hey, that's the point, and I'm going to make this brief. Carrot bars and Via Viente, this new product I'm selling on my webpage. And the point is, for people who want another stream of income, network marketing is a great way to go. Okay, now, network marketing is not for everybody, and I'll be the first one to admit that. But if you are a person who's social, you talk to people, then very likely you would be a good candidate for network marketing. It's just part of what you do. And typically, some people sell to their friends and family, but I don't. And most people that are successful don't sell to their friends and family either. That's a good way to start, to kind of get your feet wet. But basically, all it takes is 1 or 2 people that take off and run with this. Other companies, take a guy like Richard Branson, billionaire. He leverages off the work of other people. He hires good people and they run his business. But he's also got $1 billion to work with. So he can put the money into the business. Most of us don't have that luxury. Anyway, also last week I didn't get to talk about Nobel Prizes. 2 prizes were given this past week, 1 in physics, 1 in chemistry. I really liked the one in chemistry where they did work on, I believe it was 3 different chemists, they did work on understanding how DNA can cure itself, can get back to normal, so to speak. It goes through a process, and this is something like, it appears to be something like happens in telecommunications, something I'm very familiar with. If you probably wonder, if you have bad noise or a bad line, how can you send data on a bad line? Well, there's a term, it's called checksum. There's other terms for that. CRC is another name. But it's a code that some mathematicians set up, and it's a way of checking to see if the data got through correctly. And if it didn't, then you retransmit it. I worked in a team, part of my career as in telecommunications, on a team that analyzed how to do this optimally. And so basically what you do is if you have a lot of errors on the line, you retransmit, and if all of a sudden you're retransmitting, then you make the block size smaller. And you keep reducing the block size until you can get enough data through. Sometimes making the block size small causes a lot more overhead because every block has additional data that's required to send the block itself. So the end result is that you can, there's some data that can be corrected and by these methods. But anyway, these guys found a way that genes and DNA actually can do that also. That's a self-correcting mechanism. So I thought that was very interesting. So I liked that one. The physics prize, however, once again, very much tainted Big Bang theories. And so here's the deal. They were talking about neutrinos, and I think that the jury should still be out on this one, although it's hard to tell. But here's the situation. At one point, there was a lack of neutrinos based on the calculation of the amount of fusion going on in the core of the sun. And so what they've discovered, or they believe they've discovered, is there are three types of neutrinos. And so two of the types of neutrinos were missing from the reaction. This is the fusion reaction supposedly going on in the center of the sun. And they said, well, these change states, and by the time they get to Earth, they're no longer the neutrinos that left the type of neutrino that left the sun. And so there is some evidence to suggest that this is true, but I don't think it's enough to warrant a Nobel Prize. And I also don't like the idea that they keep trying to bolster Big Bang cosmology and the idea that the core fusion idea of the sun, that the sun has its fusion in the core, in the solar core. And it's just not true. And in my DVD number 4, one of the points I make is that even if you took all the mass of the sun, there's not enough E equals MC squared conversion energy to tell you to account for the 4.5 billion year age of the sun. So at any rate, I'm a little skeptical of that. These prizes are very political, and especially in physics. A couple years ago, they gave a Nobel Prize, very political, to the IRAS team, the Infrared Astronomical Observatory, that was launched ages ago. And once again, they claimed that it was proof of the Big Bang, solidifying this concept of the Big Bang even more when it's just patently totally incorrect. At any rate, here's a new department at NASA that had started actually in the year 2003. Dr. Catherine Connolly discovered spores on spacecraft that were going to Mars, etc. And they're trying to keep these spacecraft germ-free before they send them off and send them to another planet, something that's almost impossible to do. But I praise the idea, but once again, it's really, they're basically polluting these planets that they're going to with Earth-based bacteria. And so in 20 or 50 years, when somebody else gets to these same objects, how are we going to know that NASA didn't pollute that, and what we're seeing is an end result of something that came from Earth? Really, we're not going to be able to say that. And it's like the space junk problem. NASA started blowing bolts and other space junk into outer space. Now there's tens of thousands of pieces of space junk floating around out there so that when the next person goes out there, they have to encounter all of this garbage floating around in outer space, and it's moving very quickly and can destroy your spacecraft. Not a good deal. So at any rate, also NASA bringing things back to Earth from outer space is even worse, because we're talking about space-based viruses, can be some pretty mean things, and of course the human or plant life or animal life in general would not be able to combat these viruses. So just bad policy. Here's an interesting story. This was in Michigan. A mastodon was, or woolly mammoth was discovered. And as they're digging it up out of the ground, it was a skeleton, basically. And they thought that maybe it was a kill from a caveman type of scenario. But as they're pulling it up out of the ground, the article goes, oh, this 12,000-year-old mammoth. And it's like, wait a minute. You're just pulling this up out of the ground. You haven't even scraped the dirt off it yet, and you're stating that it's 12,000-year-old. And then later in the article, it talks about they're having to do dating of the bones to see how old it is. There's quite a bit of evidence to suggest that the mastodons lived up to as recent as 4,500 years ago. And that's common when you're in that field to understand that the mastodons died off not a long time ago, not 12,000 years ago, but that's the standard story where the idea is that Earth all of a sudden jumped up and did this glaciation all by itself. No, what happened is that Earth passed through a comet tail, took on a good deal of water as it fell down. Also, this was blocking the sunlight. So it came in as snow and ice packed down, and that's what causes these glaciers. At any rate, that could have easily happened within the last 5,000 years, certainly not 12,000 years. But once again, this idea of putting a date on something where they just pull that date out of a rabbit hat, pretty ridiculous. This brings up another topic that most news media right now are flushing out any older news reporters, and they're putting in new, young news reporters, and I call them bubbleheads, because, or bobbleheads maybe would be a better term, because they really don't have any experience. So you see these pictures of them up at the top of the article with their little smiling, I just graduated from college face, and, you know, not having any clue of how the world works or what's going on or how to ask a decent question. They have absolutely no experience, zero experience, and they're out there writing articles. So you're going to see a lot more of this in the future. Well, that covers topics that I was going to talk about last week, and now we're getting back to this week. A very interesting twist is coming out of standard science. Apparently, a mathematician has found a flaw in the global climate change software that everybody seems to have been using for decades and decades and decades to try and pawn this off on you, the public. And I've said all along, I don't need to examine their software. Anytime you do computer modeling, it depends on a lot of factors. And unfortunately, the real world and the real universe is far more complicated than the silly little computer models that people have put together. And really, global warming or global cooling or whatever might go on is directly related to solar input, nothing else. But this mathematician discovers a flaw in the software, saying that they have exaggerated the temperature rise due to CO2 by 5 to 10 times. And then the clown goes that, oh, gee, it still exists, but it's not the effect they had before. And so this is apparently being peer-reviewed and will be published, I imagine, and will be published. But what a wrench in the works. But there's another twist to this. You have to understand why these things are allowed. This is the ticket. The global climate change agenda is failing. Here's why it's failing. The people are turning away from this and simply leaving. Intelligent people, people from all walks of life, they're tired of the rhetoric, they're tired of politics, they're tired of watching politicians on TV or the next wave of presidential candidates. People are just like, I don't even want to hear about it. I don't even want to see it anymore. They're tired of the evening news and the jobless rate and the stock market crisis and the home market crisis and whatever else they try and stick down your throat on the evening news. People are like, I don't even watch the news anymore. More people are getting their news from a radio show like this, or radio shows where I'm a guest. But here's what's going on. Not 10,000, not 50,000, not 100,000, not 500,000, but millions. Millions of Americans have just stepped off the boat and just gone their own way. Many are still in the United States. Some have left the United States. And without saying anything, they're not getting up and marching up and down the street and carrying a banner. They just are leaving. They're just done. No more. And so the New World Order is having some real problems. First of all, they got a bad boy over there in Russia. Putin is not playing the party line like he's supposed to. And second of all over the world, not just in the United States, but all over the world, the people are just going, hey, I've had enough, I'm out of here. You know, they're getting a little piece of land, they're starting to grow crops, they're starting to save seeds. And the reality is that these people are not going to come back. You know, they're just, and the other thing is, we always think of back to the land people as, oh, they're going to, you know, live like a hippie and grow their hair long and, poor hygiene or, you know, any of those things, any of those incorrect stereotypes. These are intelligent people and they want to live a full life of intelligence, of research, of working on better ways to live. Simpler ways, and they realize that driving up and down that road every day to a 40-hour-a-week job ain't the way to go. And so this has taken off. And back in the 60s, there was kind of a back-to-the-land movement. And a lot of those people eventually left. But this time, people are just leaving for good. And they're actually, like I say, now I get a lot of feedback because people are using my books to homeschool their kids. This is becoming very common. People are, they're so tired of the standard textbooks that they get that are government issued, completely full of lies and misinformation. And so they want their kids to learn something real, how to think. And people don't listen to me because I have 18 PhDs and 10 badges. They listen to me because what I say makes sense, because you can understand it too. I'm not asking you to believe me because of, you know, rows and columns of PhDs lined up saying the same thing. What I'm telling you, you can understand yourself. And so when I do things like the Wing Generator Project, which, by the way, is coming along nicely, I don't have a release date yet, but when this comes out, it's going to make a lot of people happy. And that's the kind of thing that's going on. But just back to the concept of people leaving, just dropping everything. I'm out of here. See you later. And they're not going to come back. They're not going to vote. They're not going to march up and down the streets with placards. They're not going to go to Washington. They simply left. And I have a name for this. I call it First Nation, where people simply live their own democracy. They're good people. They're not out there to hurt people. One of the things is they want to brand these people as survivalists, or preppers, or all these other names, and they have TV shows to try and basically twist it and make them look weird or something. Now, these people are the ones that got their head on their shoulders. They're tired of running around chasing the worthless dollar. And by the way, talking about the worthless dollar, another state just came out, namely Colorado, said that they are going to use gold as a monetary standard. Remember that the states have power to issue their own monetary systems. And this is something that's coming down the line. And so, once again, Karat Bars is way ahead of the curve. The bit currencies, I don't really have anything to do with myself. If people like them, that's fine. I don't have anything against that. People, you know, but with gold currencies, you actually have, and I like this idea of gram gold as a form of currency. It's kind of like having 50-cent pieces instead of $50 bills. And that's the problem with most gold. What are you going to buy for $1,100? Kind of hard to buy a loaf of bread. What are you going to do? Shave off a little edge and say, here's my gold for the loaf of bread? No. You know, that's why you need a method, which Karat Bars has done. But back to the idea of people simply dropping out and leaving. It's something really that you wouldn't believe the numbers. And I've talked about this in my show last year. 2014, the official number was like maybe 2,000 people actually registered and left the United States, disavowing their citizenship. The real number was like 55,000, which they didn't want to report. But the other thing is, other people, they're not filing a form or they're not doing anything. They're just, hey, they're gone. They're left. They're not going to bow to any more government formalities or forms or fill something out or register, be stamped okay. They're gone. And that's great. I love it. By the way, this in from a listener I was talking to, and he said educated. His definition of educated is anyway, what education means today, it says educated today means you are successful. Educated today means you successfully repeated everything you were told to repeat. I love it. This is what people come up with, and it's really true. I mean, that's if, you know, you got that little stamp on your forehead, you got your degree, you know, you got all A's. Oh, isn't that great? And there's nothing wrong with getting A's. Get you wrong. But too many times we put all our eggs in that basket. And there's too many kids that have all kinds of talents just oozing out of their bodies in all directions, and they're not being allowed to utilize that talent. They're told to sit in a chair for 12 years and listen and repeat. That's pretty boring. Just a quick note on Germany. All eyes should be on Germany these days. It is just under a vicious attack from the New World Order, and it's the economically it's the most powerful country in the European Economic Union. But the whole issue with Volkswagen and this scandal deal, now that's, you know, they can trump up anything against anybody. How much corruption and scandal is there in the in government? You know, they don't say anything about that. They're trying to bring down Volkswagen and other car makers, but Volkswagen is the biggest employer in all of Germany. So they're trying to bring down the biggest company, the largest employer of upper middle class workers, and based on climate change, as you get kind of the link here, they're saying they broke the laws on environmental climate change. Well, how about people bringing oil from the Mid East instead of getting it locally and then burning 10% of the oil just to get it here? What's wrong with that? Nobody's bothering to talk about that at all. These people don't give a hoot about the environment. Not at all. We wouldn't even be driving gasoline cars if they did. But also Merkel is bringing in Arabs by the tons to destroy the economy. They're doing that to all countries, but Germany especially is getting slammed. Merkel, the Chancellor of Germany, got together with Mark Zuckerberg, the Facebook billionaire guy, and her comment to him was, is Facebook ready to make sure there's no negative commentary on Facebook regarding the Arab issue in Germany? So she's there to destroy that country. That's her job right now. And Facebook would be a way for people to communicate. They've got that in place now. And that's what the big shutdown of Facebook. Remember about a week ago, Facebook shut down for a day? It was all about upgrading the software. And Zuckerberg gave Merkel the nod that, yes, the Facebook software is all ready so that they won't allow any negative commentary. I think I mentioned this on the show, but I'll repeat it, that when CNN did a big cover story on the Mars water story, which I've covered for a few weeks now, I'm not going to be talking about that too much today, but there was a bubble-headed journalist, little college grad, with smiley face, bubble-headed, not having any clue what's going on the planet, who wrote the article. So I did a tweet. I clicked on the tweet on that page, which should have allowed me to make a quick comment, and that tweet would have carried to my tweet network. And I said, it's bubble-headed, young, inexperienced reporters like you that that allow NASA to promulgate their Tier 2 baloney science, something to that effect. So I hit the tweet button. It was blocked. This is what's going on. You're not going to be allowed to make any comment that doesn't go along with the party line. Control of the internet. And that's all of these outages for Facebook and Twitter and Skype, etc. Okay, next topic. This is coming around big time. The question, is the Earth flat? Woo! Well, let me give you a little calculus lesson here. Let's take a curved surface, okay? And let's, this is a literally something you do in calculus, a branch of mathematics, if you're not familiar with that. And let's take a curved surface, like a surface of a basketball or something like that, or the Earth. And let's go down to a small subdivision. Okay, that small subdivision is approximately a plane. And that's assuming there's no hills or mountains or ditches or river ravines or anything else. We're just talking about a smooth, perfectly billiard ball smooth surface globe. Okay, so if you go down to a very small portion of that, cut out a little teeny piece of the surface and look at it, even under a microscope, it's going to look pretty flat. So that's what people are getting, this illusion that somehow the Earth is flat. So microscopically, on a very local basis, if you're sitting in your room and watching TV or playing video games, you could become convinced that the Earth is flat. Maybe, if you really didn't think about it too much. But let me tell you how to measure, and let me just continue on that vein. The point of calculus is, if you go to an infinitely small piece of that surface, it would approach being a perfect plane. But it never quite gets there. Okay, so that, let's take a look at a human being on planet Earth. Planet Earth is, you know, 8,000 miles in diameter, about 24,000 miles around, something like that, more or less. But here we are, 6 feet tall. Not very tall, and so locally, it appears that the Earth is relatively flat. So it didn't take too much for the Catholic Church back in the Middle Ages to pawn that piece of Tier 2 science off on the public. But why is it making a revolutionary comeback now, is the question. I think it's a test to see how stupid people are, and maybe it's a bit of a joke people are trying to play. But here's the thing. Let's be scientific about it. Everybody might think, well, gee, I can't get into outer space, so how could I measure the diameter of the Earth? Well, the Greeks did it very simply. They took a stake, a vertical stake, at one location, and then a guy went, I believe it was about 400 miles away, or possibly farther, I forget the exact details, with a stake, and put it vertically, and at the exact noon, they measured the shadows, and by measuring the shadows, they were able to actually calculate approximately the diameter of the Earth and the circumference of the Earth and the roundness of the Earth. They were able to calculate that. And so also, if you look up in the sky, the sun's round, the moon's round, you know, Jupiter's round. It's big enough to where you can actually see it's round. Mars is round. You can actually see it with the naked eye, etc. So other celestial objects are round. But, you know, there again, let's go back to Earth. As far as calculating the circumference or diameter or curvature of the Earth, it's very simple. And all you need is a 500-foot elevation above the Earth and then overlooking a vast body of water, like an ocean or like a big lake, like the Great Lakes, for example, or the Caspian Sea, or, you know, some big body of water where you can see all the way to the horizon. Okay, now you get up on your 500-foot hill or mountainside or whatever, and if it's higher, even all the better. Take with you a level. And now when I did this, I used a surveying transit, something that I've taken around the world with me when I've done surveying on archaeological sites, etc. But and that has a level that comes with it. So basically, get up on your in this. So I'm telling you how to do this with just some primitive equipment. Also, you'll need basically a compass and a protractor, so you can measure angles. So take your level, just a regular carpenter's level or whatever, take it up to your 500-foot elevation overlooking the sea and look out across the horizon. And you can look out in any direction. So that doesn't matter. It's not had like it has to be pointed perfectly offshore or anything like that. Just in any direction, as long as you're looking out at along that body of water that ends at the horizon. Okay, so put your level. And now what you're going to notice is if you look out over that horizon, the level that you have, and you look right down the line of the level, the horizon of the water is going to be a little bit below. And that is what you're going to measure. And there's actually a calculation, if you know trigonometry, you could actually work that out. It's a little bit of a complex trigonometric problem. But where did I put that? I don't know if I put it on my web page or if I, where did I post that? But anyway, it's a fairly simple calculation. Also, if you get up high enough, you can actually see the curvature of the Earth. Now, to the contrary, you don't even have to do this, because if the Earth were flat and had an infinite extent, then here's what you'd see. When you get up to your 500-foot mountain, you would see a horizontal line, and it would extend out directly in line with your carpenter's level or transit level or whatever you were using. So when you look to the horizon of the water would not be a little bit below, but it would be perfectly in line with that crosshairs in the transit or your level. So you can literally measure the curvature of the Earth using a level. Now, let's say you were a primitive society and you didn't have the convenience of going to the hardware store and getting a nice carpenter's level. You could use a bowl of water, something as simple as that. And what would you do? You would fill the bowl up with water, and you drill a little hole in one side and a little hole in the other side of the bowl. And, okay, you fill up the bowl with water, and then you level it so that the water is just about to drip out of the hole in one side and just about to drip out of the hole in the other side. And then you look down the plane of the water, and what you're going to see, once again, is that the water level at the horizon is below the water level of your either carpenter's level or bowl of water or whatever you choose to use. Okay, enough of that. The world is not flat, but I think they're just doing this to see how amazingly stupid some people are in believing that the Earth is flat. And, you know, I think this has all started since I started hammering it down people's throat that the flat Earth teachings of the Catholic Church in the Middle Ages, how absurd it was. And so everything I do these days has somebody trying to pick it apart, and that leads me into the next story. There, NASA has had four major announcements about water on Mars in the last since last May. Last May, the Michael Mumma story comes out. Michael Mumma of Goddard, who's been busy, spent part of his life stealing my material. Anyway, in my weather book, published in probably 2004, I have eight plates that are the complete surface area of Mars, and I give all the reasons why Mars had oceans recently, and I give all of the data where the oceans were, etc. And I've been doing this for a lot longer than that book has been out even. I've been talking about this topic, taking data, photos of the surface of Mars, and talking about the recent oceans. And on my Picture of the Day subpage, I've been quite successful at convincing a lot of people out there that Mars had oceans recently. So in May, Michael Mumma, Goddard Space Flight Center, and one of his little lackey graduate students took the story and said, and they used exactly my maps and painted it blue where the oceans were and said, Mars had oceans, but oops, it was billions of years ago. Okay, so there's been a couple since, and I've talked about this on radio shows, so I'm not going to go repeat all of this. But this last week, NASA came out with a paper. It was written up in Atlantic Monthly. Some listeners sent this in, talking about Mars having oceans, and more recently in history. Now, isn't that interesting? Gee, I wonder where they got that idea. But what they said is, oops, an asteroid hit Venus, or hit an asteroid hit Mars and blew the oceans off, end of story. And that's really stupid, because there's no major asteroid holes in Mars. We have these little teeny pockmarked asteroid holes, but nothing big enough to cause it to completely vaporize the entire oceans of Mars. So throw that one out with the baby in the bathwater. Then they go, one of the other theories is that Mars had a magnetic field, and it lost its magnetic field, and because it lost its magnetic field, it lost its oceans. Huh. What are these people smoking over there? What does a magnetic field have to do with keeping oceans? Well, literally, it has nothing to do with it. Because we have Pluto. Doesn't have a magnetic field, but it's got oceans with water. How about Titan? Has oceans of methane, but no magnetic field. So how does it maintain the oceans? And methane is far more volatile than water. So, and the atmosphere of Titan is also methane. So if it doesn't have a magnetic field, if Titan doesn't have a magnetic field, how can it have an atmosphere and oceans of something? So anyway, and by the way, Mars is terraforming. It's building up atmosphere as we speak. It has been for the last 20 years. When comet sighting spring came by, it added a lot of atmosphere. So at any rate, no, the real story is that Mars lost its atmosphere when Venus the comet came by. But that, once again, is what NASA is trying to protect you from. They don't want you to know about that. Okay, so anyway, this brings up another topic, however, a discovery that I've made in the last week, putting together kind of like a detective story, the pieces of the puzzle. And here is the situation. Mars recently had a major moon. There's no question about it anymore. Because and this is something I announced, and it's probably what led to the NASA announcement about magnetic fields on Mars. But Mars definitely had a major moon. Now, there's an empirical law that, I wouldn't call it a law, it's an empirical realization that all of the planets that have significant moons have significant magnetic fields. All of the planets that don't have significant moons or lunar activity do not have magnetic fields. That one might give you the belief that there's something related between moons and magnetic fields. Okay, but I want to credit this with a guy named Stan Dermott. When I was at Cornell, he was an independent scientist up in the Space Science Building at Cornell, And he was from England, very congenial, as with many people from England, very mild, courteous, etc. And he's the guy that came across the idea that moons dance, especially moons in the rings of Saturn, etc., do a little dance, that they, when they come up and approach each other, they dance around each other, and so they really don't collide when they're in those types of orbits. Very interesting phenomena. But anyway, it was Stan's idea that the planets, at least empirically, are related to the planets that have magnetic fields, also have major moons, and somehow these were related. But he didn't really understand how they were related or why they were related. What my work came up with is that the moon was out in the solar wind, which caused it to charge, and now you have a charged body moving around that planet, and that's what drives, one of the drivers of the magnetic field of the planet. Then I discovered the five-layer model of the magnetic fields of Earth, which the inner part of that is physically in the surface of Earth, actually magnetic fields locked into the geology of Earth. But then above that we have the jet streams. The northern and southern hemisphere jet streams go easterly. They kind of snake around the planet in an easterly direction. And in the westerly direction around the equator is an electron beam. The westerly flowing electron stream is around the equator, very linear. Then you go up to the ionosphere. There are also belts, counter-rotating belts of electrical current in the ionosphere. Then you go out to the Van Allen belts. You have two belts. You have the electrons going one way, and you have the protons going the other way in the Van Allen belts. And then the final layer is a geomagnetic plasma shield, magnetic field that lies, it looks like a comet, really, long on the tail side, on the anti-sunward side. But anyway, this is the five-layer model. That's the simple version of the five-layer magnetic field model of planet Earth. What they've discovered on Mars is that there are traces of magnetic field locked into the planetary surface. So that implies that the surface material heated up, and then as it cooled down through the Curie temperature, the nickel and iron, etc., solidified a magnetic field within, locked it in those metals. And that's an indication that Mars had a significant magnetic field at one time. But it's related to having a moon. So I combined those two stories, and also the understanding that it's the charging of the moon out in the solar wind that causes the, and this is moving around the planet, and the planet is spinning underneath this moon, and that's what causes the central electrical currents. And all of these magnetic fields are coupled together, as magnetic fields like to do. Okay, so anyway, back to Mars. Mars, therefore, had a major moon. And it had it probably up until recent times. Because here's the other factor. If Mars had advanced life, which we now are very sure it did, I've been announcing this and talking about this in previous shows, then it also needed a significant magnetic field that blocked the solar wind from reaching the planet. If the solar wind reaches the planet, they turn into X-rays, and it's very damaging. Not a lot is going to live on that planet. So that's another reason for understanding that Mars had a moon up until recent times. Also probably lost that moon when the large comet Venus came by and left the two little teeny moons that we see there today. But anyway, yeah, Mars had a major moon into historical times. And so it would be an interesting research project to go back and really study, now that we know that, to see if there are any historical references to that. Just a quick update on the planet Pluto. NASA claimed they were going to have this major league announcement about Pluto. And it really was kind of not very exciting announcement. They said they discovered water, which we already knew. And then they said that the haze in the atmosphere, which had been observed by the New Horizons spacecraft, was a chemical called thulines. And so they were a combination of methane and nitrogen and hydrogen compounds, very light compounds, and they fall to the ground. And said they, so they said, yeah, these are freezing out of the atmosphere and falling to the ground, which begs the question, well, where do they come from? How come they keep, if they freeze and fall out of the sky off to the ground of Pluto, how come you still see them in the atmosphere? Shouldn't that have ended a long time ago? So there's obviously an ongoing process here. Once again, this is material that's coming in the comet tail of planet Pluto. So Pluto is acting like a comet, and this material falling in is an ongoing process. So Pluto, once again, acting just like it's supposed to, just like a comet. That's something I predicted before New Horizons ever got to Pluto. And then I captured one photo. It's on my webpage on the Picture of the Day subpage dealing with Pluto. But it actually showed the time-lapse photography showing the comet tails around Pluto, Charon, its biggest moon, and the other four moons. There's five moons around Pluto. But it actually showed the comet tails as they whipped around in outer space, the moons whipping around Pluto, and it showed the tail of Pluto also quite active moving around. So anyway, that's something you can view on my webpage. Pictures of the day. I'm spending, by the way, a lot of time. I'm trying to spend a lot of time with the Picture of the Day subpage. That's the page where it's really the most fun to write about, because you get to see a picture and look at these details yourself. What I have up there now is a picture of the Martian South Pole showing the ice cap in winter, and then talking about the various other water features in that picture. That's what's on the front of my homepage. And then there's a link to the subpage, the Picture of the Day subpage, and you can go there, and there's pictures going back a long ways with explanations. Okay, so in the last 12 minutes I've got of this show, I'm going to talk about conservation of energy. And I'm going to discuss three major accepted theories of standard science, and I'm going to show why they're completely incorrect. And you can prove that from a concept called conservation of energy, something that science seems to have forgotten somewhere along their misguided way. Conservation of energy simply means that if you have an energy source, or you see something, an energetic process going on, something moving, something happening, something changing, then energy is involved. Things happen because of energy. It's not enough to say, well, El Nino caused it, or La Nina, or whatever. That doesn't tell you anything. What you have to do is, if you're really going to make statements like that, you have to identify the energy source, show how it's transferred into the process, in this case weather, and show that connection. But they never do that. They just have this, oh, everything El Nino caused it. It can cause everything, including the kitchen sink. But the three concepts I want to concentrate tonight are plate tectonics, hurricanes, and lightning. So what do those three things have in common? Number one, standard science has no clue how they work. Number two, the failed ideas that they present don't abide by the law of conservation of energy. And so anyway, with that, I'm going to show you how these processes do work and conserve energy at the same time. Okay, so let's look at plate tectonics. That's the concept that on Earth or some other planet, aged planet that's cooling down, you have surface plates that move around the planet. But you have a little problem. In the middle of these plates, you have vast mountainous areas, sometimes towards the edge of the plate also. But here's the issue. Calculate the mass and the potential energy of the mountain range. Calculate how much mass is up there. how do you get that much mass pushed up into the air? Okay, this requires work. This requires energy. And the simple equation for work is simply force times distance. So you need a force, and that force has to be sufficient to lift all of that mountain range up in the air. Very simple. Conservation of energy. Now let's look at what they claim is the cause of this. They say this is plates at the boundary of the plates. One is subducting under the other, subduction. One rides down below the other one, and the other plate rides up over the other one. Well, I'm trying to figure out where the force is here that creates these mountain ranges. And they go, oh, well, that's caused by the plates moving, causing pressure in the middle of the plates and forcing these mountains to grow. But that's all great in a, you know, high school text or a college text or even a PhD textbook. That's just wonderful. But where is the Herculean force that causes the work to raise this massive amount of earth and rock and stone up to a level of 14,000 feet? So you calculate the potential energy in the mountain. So if all of the mass came down to ground level, how much energy would we have? And you have to discover where all of that energy comes from to create that mountain. Now, the other problem here is the plates are moving horizontal. They're moving horizontally. And where does the force come from that makes them move horizontally? Well, that's another little problem. And they say, well, there's heat that's coming up from the center of the Earth. Well, that's nice. But if there were that much heat coming up, it would simply break through that very tender surface, bubble through, and the energy would escape. And that's what we call a volcano. And there are volcanic regions along the plate boundaries. And that's where the energy goes. Now, I've created a thought experiment. And you take bulldozers. These are big, big, big bulldozers. And on both sides, they have a blade with a hydraulic blade on them. So the blade can be pushed out into the direction of the center of the plate. In other words, towards the direction of the mountains. And then the blade on the other side has this big hydraulic, and so it's like you're standing in between the two plates and you have these big blades and you're going to push outwards. What would really happen is you would get simply deformed material in the region of these massive bulldozers, and it would be a localized event, and it would not translate into mountain building 2,000-3,000 miles away, or 1,000 miles away, or 500 miles away in the center of the plate. And besides, even if you could put a force on that, that force would be lateral. So how do you get the mountains to raise up? All of this matter. You need a vertical force times distance. Horizontal force doesn't cut it. So how do you make this happen? Well, the way mountains are built is when a large comet comes by near enough, it causes a gravitational wave in the surface. When that wave is traveling through the ground, just like an ocean wave, that energy comes upon a resistance in the ground, typically where the mountains already exist, and that energy is absorbed, and that's what raises the mountain up. So it's a tremendous geological event. But the Earth doesn't just jump up and do this by itself. And how do you prove it? Very simply. Where do you get the energy, Mr. Geologist, looking in your textbook? Where does the energy come from to raise all of that material up? It's the plate tectonics does not explain it. So topic number two, hurricanes. Hurricanes are said to be formed by warm water. Once again, where does the energy come from? Okay, so talking about hurricanes, let's dismiss the concept, and this is not a standard science concept, but it's just something we have to talk about. The hurricane itself does not have an internal heat source. The energy for the hurricane has to come from someplace else, because if the hurricane just sat there spinning all by itself, it would dissipate in a couple minutes. How does a 200-mile-an-hour or 100-mile-an-hour wind continue to blow into the center of this storm and with no internal energy source to cause this? Well, something outside has to cause this. But there, we have to mix something else. It's called the second law of thermodynamics. This is coupled very integrally with the concept of conservation of energy. If you have a box full of hot air and you open it up, let's put it this way, if you have a box of hot air, what's going to happen to that? The energy is going to dissipate. It's going to go away in all directions, and it's not going to form an organized storm. This is the natural process of nature. So let's take, instead of a box of hot air, we're going to take an ocean of warm water, of relatively warm water. Now, how can you take that energy, somehow accumulate it, and drive it into a storm, that some like a hurricane? Well, it doesn't happen. It's impossible. So the concept that they're trying to tell everybody about hurricanes, that they're formed by warm water, is completely absurd. It couldn't possibly be true. Next, let's look at lightning. Lightning, what we see is it comes out of the bottom of a cloud. So that's our first perception, is somehow that cloud is causing lightning. But when they send an aircraft or a balloon up into a cloud, there's no electric field inside the cloud. So how exactly is that happening? Where's the lightning coming from? And so once again, they say, well, that's the upwelling currents, gas currents or wind currents in the cloud that causes the differential voltage. And even if that were happening, the electrical discharges would occur within the cloud. It wouldn't be a reason for lightning to come shooting out of a cloud. So the end reason, the end result is that hurricanes are driven by electrical currents from the ionosphere, and lightning is driven by electrical currents from the ionosphere. Where does that energy come from? It comes from Earth discharging the electric field of the sun, plasma physics. And where does the sun get its energy? From burning fusion, from burning hydrogen. So there is a real analysis of conservation of energy, but you have to find the energy sources. You have to find how they're transferred into these energy systems that we see and what continues to move these processes. Go to my webpage, jmccsci.com. The water filters, the book packages, the recalendar sun-star clock, the pre-filter, the only place in the world you can find this on my website. Look also the main homepage, the picture of the day subpage. All of the archives for this radio show are on the webpage. And also take a look at Carrot Bars and Via Viente. Great products that you can purchase, and then also you can become dealers with these. So a very important information, how to become financially healthy and physically healthy, Carrot Bars and Via Viente. This is Jim McCanny. This is my Science Hour, and as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.